off of Walter.
I'll survive.
Sorry. Okay, should we get started? It's my pleasure to introduce Eric Orbitz, a longtime biomedical and health informatics researcher. I'll just call him that rather than...
Did you say long-time biomedical and health informatics faculty member?
Well, you'd love to. Although he is primarily at Microsoft Research. I've known him for a long time. He's done some great work. And he always gives a very interesting talk. In fact, he said he was particularly excited about this talk, so that's a good sign.
Well, thanks, John. I find this work kind of fun and engaging. And this is for joint work with Ryan White, the team at Microsoft Research. So the web has become the center, or actually the vortex of health information. We could actually use the web and web logs to gain access to that at places like Microsoft and Google. We have access to these big blue search logs to build models of user needs over time, intentions as they change. We can start thinking about models of cognition, for example, how cognitive biases might work to guide behavior. It's a very rich space we're finding. We've been particularly interested in looking at health search as one of the foci of work on our team. You can imagine what you might do if you were interested in one or more aspects of how people, consumers, or experts look for health care information or medical or biomedical information. Looking at query sequences and page accesses, even checking into the content distribution on the web, how content is changing. One might even build predictive models from the data to try to maybe predict and build new kinds of services that might provide visions for future, the way the future web might work, and so on. I was particularly interested in diagnosis via the web managed to get Ryan White interested in this as well. I think a lot of this interest came from my own personal use and family use of the web as a diagnostic tool. But it intrigued me, given my long-term interest in medical expert systems, how we're in an era now where people look at a search inbox and Google or Bing as kind of a really bright oracle. Should know everything. Well, it's also, of course, you just assume you can put sets of symptoms in and find out what's wrong with you or what might be, is it serious or not, for example, or a friend or family member. And so we started looking at interesting word that we found, and I'll tell you about some background on this, that diagnostic pursuits on the web were leading to often unfounded medical anxieties. We did a paper that appeared in TOAS in 2008, I believe, maybe 2009, but there was an article featuring this work in the New York Times that year. And that year, I think cyberchondria was one of four new words in Webster's. We defined what we meant by that and why in that work. As far as some background work on people's use of the web as a diagnostic tool, as the modern-day expert system in medicine, this is a Pew Internet American Life Project survey that found with health search for U.S. consumers, 66% had actually searched for disease or medical problem information, 56% for medical treatment or procedures, and so on. You can see, by the way, that diagnostics is a big component of how people are actually even using the web. We did a survey at Microsoft Corporation across our sites. We have an online tool called Consensus, which lets us create surveys to just probe this phenomena. Whether you think, you know, sort of generally computer savvy, information workers, how they're using the web. And we had a cohort size of 515 here, and we asked questions like, on average, how many health-related web searches do you do per month, and so on. How many health-related web searches for professionally undiagnosed medical conditions do you perform per month? When you seek health-related information online, what do you search for? And we, right here at the top, 85.8% information on symptoms like headache, chest pain, and so on. Information on serious medical conditions, et cetera, medical diagnoses. So you see, like, the people are saying, like, the bulk of this work is, like, medical expert system use of the web. Also, interestingly, is the notion of health-related anxieties in the web. Have you ever been concerned about having a serious medical condition based on your own specific own observation of your symptoms when no condition was present? And you see, for Microsoft people, probably same as UW people, you know, people kind of worried about their health at all times. 40% have a concern like that. And then, of course, there's been web searches. How often do you search the web for symptoms and basic medical conditions, and how often does it lead you to your review of content on serious illness? And you see, it's up to occasionally and rarely you're getting, you know, 90%. People have sort of been led into these serious illness reflections, discussion. And then we, in this part of the survey on persistence and interruption, why the concerns? People are actually sometimes coming back again and again when they get nervous about their illness to the web again with repeat searches. People are actually escalating. They actually are being interrupted by the search about illness when they should be doing other things that might be bring them more happiness and reward in life. And the anxiety is often related to the content of pages visited from a click. Web search result pages, mention of serious explanations, presence of escalatory terminology, grave, fatal, life-threatening, and serious. So we saw, you know, and even the whole notion of people often even consider, and we'll come back to this in a few minutes, the search ranking of return results as being linked to the likelihood of illness. So it's like an expert system here. People saying, oh my God, this is like, I see this serious illness at the top of the list. That's the differential diagnosis. I'm in big trouble here. Or even this notion here is left here. So basically, have you ever used web search as a medical system? You ask that frank question where you input symptoms and expect to review possible diseases ranked by likelihood. Microsoft folks, 1 out of 4, right? And do you believe you've been, and I'll get back to this also in a few minutes, this is all just setting up for the study now. Do you believe you've been in a situation where web content put you over the threshold for scheduling an appointment with a health professional when you had not have done so otherwise? So the web is now, for some people, leading them to health care utilization investment or cost. Most times, the appointment was not justified when they actually left the doctor with a smile on their face. So we did a few studies. First of all, we said, well, why is this the case? We started probing this situation. And I'm personally fascinated as to what we're finding as to what's going on with the web. And this is the healthcare or the use of the web for diagnostic search. You can take this as one example of, you might say, an interesting area for study of the intermixture of human cognitive bias and biases on the web that people don't realize on either side in advance. So first of all, we asked the question, how common are the... What's the co-occurrence of common symptoms that are often linked to common explanations, benign explanations, and the same symptoms linked to serious and rare disorders, like headache and brain tumor, muscle twitches, which happened to everybody, and Lou Gehrig's disease. It's often a pathognomonic sign for that kind of an illness starting, and so on. So we did a random sample of the web, 40 million pages in a breadth-first crawl, just get a sense of what are the co-occurrences of a bunch of medical symptoms and serious versus benign disorders. We also did two kinds of search, search across the whole web, like a Google or Bing search across the whole web, and then going into a curated site like MSN Health or Mayo Pages and doing a search within those pages for some basic symptoms, and then looked at the co-occurrence of terms in the top 100 results for each of these kinds of studies. Bing and then sort of and so on. So let me show you some of the results here. So what you see here are three common symptoms: headache, muscle twitches, and chest pain as examples. We have the common explanation. By the way, when I was at Stanford Medical School, someone came to the ambulatory clinic when I did my rotations in the clinic with the worst headache of their life, and they're basically expecting the worst. It was almost always caffeine withdrawal. They just forgot their coffee for 2 days or so, and got nausea, unremitting headache, and they think the world's coming to an end, and it's a very common scenario. Brain tumor is quite rare. I'll talk about that in a few minutes. Yet, when we do a co-occurrence on the web, we see that brain tumor, with the crawl of the web, is at 0.03. Caffeine withdrawal is much higher, but it's still not low enough. If I do web search, let me highlight these for a second here. If I do web search, open web search, brain tumor, it co-occurs with the same frequency with headache as caffeine withdrawal, caffeine close attention. And if I go back to the domain search, right away we're cleaning things up. It's like the coverage goes way down. So we're seeing expertise is pretty good with the crawl, the domain search, medical expert site. But web, open web, it's awful. It's basically you get right to the serious disease right away. Same for if you look at ALS and muscle twitches. I always tell people, if you have a twitching eyelid or a twitch in your sphenar muscle and so on, do not ever put that into a web search engine, because you will be right away. You'll be at an ALS support group. You'll get routed right there, and you'll be very worried about, you know, this is the first sign, and in 6 months you'll be losing all your muscular functionality and so on. In reality, it's very, you know, benign fasciculations and even twitches more generally are very commonplace. Yet there's a co-occurrence of muscle twitches and ALS, 0.5 open web search. Even the crawl is pretty high. Domain search is quite good. Chest pain as well, and heart attack. Again, it's much higher than it should be. It's competing with indigestion and heartburn. Now, that was the first part of our studies. By the way, on the incidence, I'll mention this again. ALS, brain tumor, 1 in 10,000 incidents per year. ALS, 1 in 55,000 or so. Heart attack, if you're less than 35 years old, it's quite rare. I'll get back to this in a few minutes. I'm a MD, PhD, trained in healthcare. It took me over an hour to find out that if I'm, let's say, a 45-year-old male, and I have severe chest pain, I have no family history or previous sign of heart disease, is it a heart attack or not? To find out that probability, it's quite low, actually, it turns out. You wouldn't know it by an open web search. You'd be racing to the emergency room. The annual incidence of the first major cardiovascular event associated with severe chest pain, you see, it's quite low, lower than you'd expect for these age groups here, and in general, quite low. So then we decided, okay, this is interesting. The web and the way the web content, and I talk about why this is in a few minutes, per the way content is generated and indexed, seems to be way biased in terms of how when a search engine indexes the web, how it's relating symptoms to top ranking pages on diseases, and why it's not a very good search engine for an expert systems role. We took Windows toolbar data, Windows Live. This was before it was Bing, this was a few years ago. So it's very similar to the Bing toolbar data over almost a year, about a year, 11-month period here. And we actually could access Google, Yahoo, and Live search queries and Bing queries. So we're seeing not just Bing, but all the queries coming into the system of somebody who loads the toolbar down, just like Google sees all the queries coming in when you have the Google toolbar down, no matter what search engine you're on. And we said, let's basically come up with a set of common symptoms. I'll talk about how we generated symptoms in a few minutes and their synonyms. Using a consumer health vocabulary, and then we expanded them with a particular procedure we used to go bounce to a web page and then back out to all the incoming searches that led to that web page to get a big expansion, capturing lots of commonly used terms. And we found, by the way, we did this, that for the medical search sessions, that 2% of all the queries were health-related. I was really shocked to see how high that was. And about a quarter of our population of users in the particular study we had issued at least one medical search. And then we actually looked at users querying on one of those 12 symptoms I just mentioned to you before, and we had about 9,000 people, about 11,000 sessions. And we looked at escalation. So when does somebody come in into their expert system, Google, Bing search engine, put some symptoms in, and then escalate something serious, some common symptoms, one of those 12 common symptoms? Here's an example of an escalation: headache. This web, well, we see the browsers as well to the pages people are going to, which is very interesting. And then then they actually expand their query to headache, or refine it to headache and tumor, and then brain tumor treatment. Here's the actual query. Here's a non-escalation headache, coffee, caffeine withdrawal symptoms. On escalations in general, looking at basic symptoms that are common, often associated with benign illness, benign explanation, I should say, escalated to serious illness and grave concern, we saw about 5.5% of the sessions would include these escalations. A lot of them were going to serious illnesses. Others have sort of more sort of terminology that we actually link to from getting emotionally concerned with how terrible their disorder was. We also saw persistence and burstiness. People would actually start coming back, and this is a sign of anxiety. They'd come back over time. 13% had repeat queries on the same kind of search. 51% or so looking at symptoms again, illnesses, and so on. So we actually did a study, and this is in our TOAS paper, of interruptions. We said, well, let's say they escalate for the first time that year in the log. What happens over the long term? And the idea of seeing people over the long term coming back, and actually you can see them in their normal course of work being interrupted midstream by their concern. So someone is doing something unrelated, and right in stream in the same session jumps to Lou Gehrig's disease again. And, you know, in the course of Lou Gehrig's disease, and what does this all mean for them, and twitching again, and so on. Some users, more than 15% of their sessions were basically just dwelling and being interrupted by their concern. So we're seeing the web as a thermometer into the minds of people and their anxiety. We can make that inference and leap here right now.
Eric, was that 5% of the original 5% that ended up?
Yes, 5.4%? Yes, yes. It's smaller than the whole web. I built a cohort, and we're now dividing it up, watching what happens with this group that sort of has those 12 symptoms.
Okay.
Right. So if people, I think you probably in this program, we'll get to Tversky and Kahneman and other psychologists and their study of heuristics and biases of judgment. But I was fortunate, I guess, at Stanford. I took a course with Elmas Tversky and really enjoyed meeting him, working with him a bit. But the psychologists have studied what are some illusions or hallucinations of judgment, both belief and judgment and action in the world. And just as background here, there's a bias called the availability bias, which says, and you can study this in the lab, and it has been studied, that the estimates people make of the likelihood of an event happening are based on how easily the example can come to mind. If you come to work and you see a couple of car accidents and someone asks you what's likely of a car accident on a morning commute, if it's more available to humans, they'll tend to give it a higher likelihood in their mind. Seeing a lot of the search engines coming up with the serious illnesses really plays on human availability bias for how likely it is that they think they have this illness. Base rate neglect, another famous bias. The idea basically is people tend to, when they see belief updates, like positive evidence or something, like a headache, yes, brain tumors do tend to cause headaches. But it's a very small update given the low prior probability you saw before. You know, the 1 in 10,000 incidence rate per year. They're not folding that prior probability in when they get an update, severe headache, even for a couple of days sometimes, whatever the headache might be. So Kahneman and Tversky also showed the power of base rate neglect. And there are other biases, confirmation bias. If you believe you have something, you'll find evidence for it, especially on the web. So here's what's going on in my mind with the web. Now, you've all learned, has everybody here learned Bayes' rule? It's basically a simple statement of probability theory. We divide of chain law, and you divide one side by probability of evidence. So it says the probability of having a disease, let's say, a hypothesis, given symptoms or evidence, is a product of the prior on the diseases, the evidential update, the likelihood of the evidence given the disease, and normalized by the evidence. I'm going to draw a little event diagram here. Here's the probability of the evidence. Let's say we'll keep it concrete. This is the probability of you having a headache, right? And this is the probability of brain tumor. It's actually made very, very big for the sake of visualization, so you can see it from where you're sitting. It's really a pinpoint. What the web is doing is, when you do web content and retrieval, because of how diseases are reported and indexed on the web, it's more salient. You see a lot more of the probability of the disease given the evidence. It looks much bigger. And you see very little information about how common headaches are. So if you take Bayes' theorem now, and you basically make the probability of the evidence smaller, and you amp up the probability of a hypothesis or brain tumor, you can see why the web would make you a hypochondriac or a cyberchondriac, right? It's pretty, I mean, the qualitative reasoning really, really, I think really, really characterizes what's going on. So that goes way up, I think, and the people have good reason to get nervous if they think that web search is a really nice way to do diagnosis. Now, here's some directions we've gone in. So I've pointed out at least one example of an interplay of the biases of judgment with the biases of the web together. I mean, Kahneman and Tversky probably say the web is biased. My God, it has its availability bias. The indexers don't know probability. They're just linking to anything that's relevant. And, oh, by the way, Bing and other search algorithms often have this. We've looked at this idea of if you click on a result and dwell on it, it's a sign that you're satisfied. That was the correct result. What happens when all these nervous Nellies are clicking on brain tumor and it goes higher and higher and higher? It's positive feedback and stays at the top. So you can imagine a lot of reasons why these things are up on top and why the search engines are being fooled even by the input. So there's a general challenge with information retrieval as diagnostic inference. We want to think about detecting diagnostic intent, maybe someday providing even coarse likelihoods right away for people to sort of try to de-bias them, or the commonality of symptoms, or the rareness of illnesses, and so on. So you can imagine there's a bunch of directions you can go to make search better for this purpose for people that will be doing this thing, given how common this kind of use of the web is. Some directions we're going in include understanding and predicting escalation, building predictive models of escalation, going from understanding how concerns evolve to world utilization of resources, emerging models of health search. Let me just tell you briefly now about what we've done on escalation now. And the idea basically was, that was our first piece of work you just saw a high-level view of. That's a TOAS 2009 paper on the core work. It's on our website if you want to read about that. The follow-on paper at SEG-IR, we said, can we actually predict that someone's going to transition from the benign common symptoms to the concerning disease process by watching their behavior on the web? Basic idea is this. Here's a sequence of, here's a session with query, page view, query, page view, page view, query. And the basic idea is we want to take, for any page, predict that the next query that follows it will be an escalatory query. Yeah?
Is this done on Microsoft computers?
Microsoft computers. This is done on large-scale search logs. Large-scale, like I mentioned before, we just leave.
The Microsoft employees were...
No. This is done with anonymized, a million-person data, fucking large-scale studies in the wild.
Okay.
And we'll get back to anonymization and privacy in a few minutes. But the idea basically here, these search logs, and what I've been talking about, since the survey has been in the wild, an 11-month looking at toolbar data across toolbar users, consenting users who said, you can do research on my queries, and click the button that says, yes, you can do that, it's fine. And we have a whole set of procedures for anonymizing this data. So we're looking at raw data. You can say, well, how do you anonymize? We talked about a few minutes, there's a whole process there. And if you're interested in or concerned about privacy, wait till we get to the mobile data. I'll tell you about it in a few minutes, which has location attached to it, and I'll tell you how we anonymize that work. So stand by 1 second on that. So I briefly mentioned Microsoft employees only for the 515-person study we did, which was a survey. Right from there, I said, let's go to the log now, open web, Wild West. Here's what you and your friends are doing and your family. Okay. So here's another example of a session here. We want to predict that someone at this page will escalate from headache here to brain tumor, symptom to a serious illness in a sequence. Now, someone in my family had a sharp throbbing pain, actually in the left side of their head a couple weeks ago. I said, hey, let's check this out, see what the web says about this. So I went to the web, and now think about the design aspects. You're not in the mood to read a big bunch of text. Well, what do you see? This is the top result, by the way, for that exact query. You see in boldface brain tumor, right? That's the way the web works. So let's jump down a bit. This is fascinating. So I got really interested with Ryan in the rhetorical structure of how pages are written on the web and how it influences people. So you go to Bing, put in chest pain, common. You see Mayo Clinic chest pain page, Wikipedia chest pain page. You can do this yourself in your own free time if you have your laptop open right now. Google, same thing. It's actually the same pages essentially. I think they ordered the same way, basically. Let's dive into the pages here. So here's the Wikipedia article. Read the first sentence here. Chest pain may be a symptom of a number of serious conditions and is generally considered a medical emergency. You having your grip in your chest, and you read that sentence, and this is a crowdsourced page, and you believe it, you say, well, I'm out of here. I'm heading to the hospital. Go to the Mayo Clinic page. If you happen to go there instead, chest pain. You ignored it at first. It's still there. You're scared and worried. Heart attack? Emergency room? Fortunately, chest pain doesn't always signal a heart attack. And then it goes on to sort of calm people down a bit and be a little bit more measured about things and read about this a bit, or friends and family, before racing off to do healthcare utilization. Now, notice that there's a kind of a serious and scary part of these stories for any rare symptom, rare scary disease attached to a common symptom. And so I say, well, that's an interesting feature of pages. Was the serious rare thing mentioned before the common benign thing? And if I just looking at would people escalate or not, you can see right away that people were much more likely to escalate the serious search on serious illnesses if they had gone to a page that happened to be had its rhetorical structure such that the scary thing came first. We actually created a whole bunch of page features, and in a minute I'm going to show how to be able to classify it to predict by watching someone's browsing patterns that they're going to get upset versus stay cool based on these features here in a large data set. So the fraction of the page that that appears after the first serious, to the first serious illness, the fraction to the first benign, the distance between the benign and serious. You can imagine a whole bunch of features we can come up with. Testimonials, I was scared, fora, that I go to a forum, that's how it started with me. I go to a forum, you say, twitching, that's how mine started. I had it for about a year, my hand was twitching. You read these forums, for example, the ALS forum, you see these kinds of sites that really scare people. So you can imagine there's a lot of features. We can just featureize these pages to capture structure and then build ROC curves to predict from a data set, in this case a balanced data set of negative and positive examples. If I use, in this case, the trying to predict that there'll be an escalation, how well am I doing? You can see for different, you can read in our paper, different variants of feature sets and how well they perform. But the idea is we have the ability now to actually literally watch a web session automatically and anonymously and understand when someone's getting a little anxious, probably because of the structure of the pages. Now, it gets kind of even more exciting. You can say, well, we sort of went from characterizing the problem, looking at how it manifests itself with some explanation, to predicting escalations, and now we want to go to web to world. So I was really interested in this question from our survey to my Microsoft people, back to the Microsoft group. Did web content ever put you over the threshold for scheduling an appointment with a health professional when you would likely have not sought professional medical attention if you had not reviewed the web content? And almost a quarter said yes. This is our AMIA 2009 paper we published that survey in. So we were just looking at the big, the way we did this, we actually have taggers working with us in our group. We bring in external taggers, we train them, and they tag thousands of queries for us. Looking for various aspects of the query. And we had queries up all around this room. And I remember I saw this query that said something like, neurologist, Chattanooga, Tennessee, or, dermatologist, Bellevue, Washington, 98052. Wow, people are getting to it. They're escalating, and they're searching, and finally they're actually looking for a doctor and an address and a phone number. So we really had our signs, like some rubber meets the road of healthcare, right in the weblog. Someone's probably, and often we found out that these healthcare utilization intention queries, as we call them, or HUIs, were often the last query in a session, and then white noise, radio silence. They're out of here. They're on the phone. They're scheduling something. And here's some examples of some HUIs, healthcare utilization intentions. We're not really sure if someone's going to hit the road with their car, but they're pretty, just doing urgent searches for, typically for some sort of care. We actually did some automated tagging of this, zip codes, medical resources, and so on that worked quite well. And then we said, can I predict someone's going to go to one of these, get to one of these points in their search? Same kind of, will a session lead to a HUI after a page? Here's one cardiologist going from chest pain to chest pain in the session without that kind of thing. Can I just predict that appearing in the search log? And we did this same analysis again. Just to push ahead here, using page structure again, like before, session information, and then user specific history over multiple sessions. Here's some of the features we used: number of queries, average query length, number of queries with escalations that are appearing, number of queries with benign explanations, the average dwell time on the pages, total dwell time on the pages. Then we have these longer term notions: the number of concerning queries per day, the number of medical sessions per day, the number of unique, we call them Merck symptoms, but Merck has a guide of the standard symptomatology, number of previous queries with serious illness, and so on. And we can build a predictor, again, that can predict someone's going to go to a healthcare utilization centric query.
So if I'm a healthcare provider and I want people to come to me,
get your ad right then.
Create a page.
Say, you know, Don Guarneri, you know, I can help you with your semantic symptomatology. So to give you a sense for some of the feature weights here, the highest, we're going to normalize the average dwell time. That was the most important feature in a session. Someone's dwelling on these pages and probably with intensity. The dwell time. The number of escalations is next in terms of the being discriminatory on HUI versus no HUI. Is there a resource link on the page, which is an address or a phone number, number of URLs in a session, and so on. What are people actually querying on it when they go to these HUIs, these health care and physician intentions? I get a sense for, here's some examples, what we saw in terms of the pie chart here. Look at it again. The details are in our papers on the web. You can read about all that. Everything I'm saying today, much more detailed on the web. Yeah?
Is this before or after?
Before or after?
Tab-based browsing, so you're looking at like time on page and stuff. Is tab browsing?
Tab browsing.
Using tabs while they're browsing.
I have to check that. I think we've normalized for intra tabs, but I think we did this. This data set is about 3 years old now, so tabs probably weren't that common back then. But we're now working with tabs and figuring out time streams from tabs in the same browser. It's funny, given I know who you are, when I was thinking, tab browsing, that's a really cool thing. What is that? Is that like you hit the tab button to go, like a real dev kind of browsing? I said, oh, you mean tabs? Yeah, okay. Oh yeah, my cognitive bias, given that he's such a hardcore heads down hacker. So what happens after HUI? It turns out, I mentioned before, in a key chunk of them, it's the last query of the session. Mean, it happens about 3/4 of the way through a session. Then when additional queries follow, we often see a refinement of the resource. Where should I go? What should I do? Sometimes more exploration of the medical condition. Sometimes a compression of two different resources, which is, I guess, a refinement there, and so on. So that gives you a sense of where we were up with maybe four or five of our papers. We're each tackling a different challenge problem, building incrementally to capture the interaction of web and people when it comes to diagnostic search. Let me tell you now about a paper that was just accepted into JAMIA just this week, actually. I thought I could talk about it, I guess. And this is mobile work. So about a year ago or so, we got access to Android and iPhone data through the Bing Top app. So people that run Bing on Android or iPhone, and they've actually, when they bring up the EULA, they actually sign off on, these are just the people who've given consent, that you can have my location data to make search better and to study my search behavior. this whole study, we don't have an IRB at Microsoft Research. We have a privacy officer. This all went through the privacy officer, quite rigorously reviewed by a committee and a panel. So the idea basically was, we're going to basically take Bing queries from mobile devices. I was really impressed with, you see sessions, GPS query, GPS query, GPS query, pause. And user IDs or grids or general IDs are maintained through the file. So we had, in the particular data set, we had about 35,000 users and several hundred thousand queries. And here's what we tried to do. We said, the challenge was, can we do a privacy-centric study with actual GPS data and queries? And I think you'll find this rather interesting. So here's what we did. We said, on this web-to-world work, I wonder if we can get, with the Bing resources, for example, all care centers in the United States. And there were 34,500 or so, 35,000 hospitals or urgent care centers in the U.S. And the idea is, for each one of those centers, I get this GPS location. I look for any query in my data set that happens right next to the hospital, within 200 meters, and go back in time and look for a symptom search. Right? Then I say, let's look at this session and see what's going on here. Obviously, you can have type 1, type 2 errors of various kinds here, but we can sort of minimize them, and we describe how in the paper. But the basic idea is, we found that about 5,000 of these users queried from within, at some point in time in this year, within 200 meters of a medical facility. Almost 3,000 of them, over 3,000 of them, queried with a symptom within 90 days before that time. So we can sort of analyze this. Here's an example. I mean, to me, this is like, the surprising magic of what's possible these days, even with anonymized data. So we threw out all absolute location data. We took the data set. We just look at relative locations to the hospital and how it changes over time to get a notion of an approach to a hospital. We throw out all query information except for symptom tokens, right? So it's completely anonymized now at the point of we're looking at it. And we can say, if someone has, this is mean hours to getting to the care center here with chest pain as the general search term here, you see it's like, it looks like about an hour, headache, dizziness, abdominal pain, palpitations, earache, rash, and you see you're getting a kind of a thermometer on how people might be using a device to how it might be influencing, sensing and influencing their progression to a care center. This basically shows, we actually can see these HUIs, these health utilization intentions in the logs, in the mobile logs. So about 13% of these HUIs and logs transition to what we call it evidence of health care. Getting near the hospital, we call it EHU. That's the phrase we use. Evidence, because we don't really know what's going on, but they're near the hospital within 30 days. And 3.5% or so of these getting near the hospital was preceded by an actual health utilization intention query. You see them, within the same session and so on later on in time. We said, can I figure out from the mobile phone data with symptoms now, whether or not somebody's going to head to the hospital? Can we give them directions, for example? We'll recommend John as the clinician. And so, we did a balanced, we took all the positives we had and balanced it with 3121 random and so the negative cases, and show for you, sort of how well we can do with different time scales with our RRC curves here. So here's the top factors here normalized to the top one: number of unique serious conditions being searched on the cell phone, number of health utilization intention queries, number of symptom searches. Has a HUI at all, did a refinement, like where should I go, which on a mobile phone. So to me, this is like, the magic of our modern times as possible for research of various kind of this type. We also want to be careful about the research and the privacy and so on as well. But I remember having this little insight that, we can just get rid of all we need is absolute information. Just throw everything else out, just get absolute proximity. No one knows where this person was, and we always see is the actual Merck mapped symptom. Yeah, please.
So how much of that is actually the relationship between you having a symptom and going to the
going to a hospital at the same time versus having a symptom and searching mobile device and then going to the hospital. Does that make sense?
I think I hear what you're saying. So because we have no back channel to ask these people to a little cracky, buzzing speaker, excuse me, are you actually having a symptom now? Or we were just looking at logs post hoc. We definitely face the challenge of incomplete data on both sides. Here, this is what makes it even worse. These search algorithms only send back GPS when someone's querying. So we don't have continuous streaming GPS to really track people. We only have the ambient GPS query. So it's not clear. What's kind of magical about this is, and we spend a lot of time in the paper talking about the incompleteness, but still we're getting some signal, we believe, and we characterize how and carefully document what we're doing to minimize the various kinds of error, the false positive, false negatives. Because there's four cases, right? You can imagine someone didn't do it's more than that actually, but didn't do a query, you know, because they were too busy with their chest pain, went to the hospital, did do a query, went to the hospital, but never queried at the hospital, so you wouldn't see them there. So it's a subset of people who happen to query at some time having a symptom. You can imagine if that goes on for a while over time, that you might see that with a higher probability given what's going on, given how common people's searches are on mobile devices these days. Doing a query at the hospital seems a little less likely in general. You know, you'd be worrying about other things at that point in time. But these devices are getting more ubiquitous, and people are using them more ubiquitously. So you think it's getting more and more of a look at this. But still, we're predicting with the data that we have quite well, we think. Yeah.
Any way to filter for people who live or work near hospitals?
Yeah, that's what we did. In fact, in the paper, we did a sensitivity analysis. But we removed all periodic went through the whole data set and looked for a periodic approach to a hospital. And removed all that. In fact, for the data you saw, all data was thrown out. Any approach to the hospital before the symptom was gone. We took the whole person out of the data set. So the data you're seeing are only, and I can't go through all the details in a few minutes, but it's in the paper, but the data you're seeing are, the cohort is people who never went to the hospital for at least 7 days before the first symptom search appeared, and then we landed at the hospital with a search. So you see, we're grappling with a keyhole and trying to do our best that we can with Bayesian methods and so on. But it's still interesting how much we're learning, I think, versus fooling ourselves. Let me end now in the last few minutes, but and then we'll just take some questions. Yeah?
I was just going to ask, how much of this web credibility studies originated from BJ Fox's work?
No. I know him.
Yeah.
And I like what he does. We sort of rely more on like the Tversky and Kahneman literature, sort of the early science in the space, and have been looking at the consumer, his persuasive work. I guess we should ask BJ Fogg if he and his team want to study how persuasive is the Wikipedia page on chest pain when it says, this is an emergency, period. That's pretty persuasive, I think. I like his work. Are you looking at his work? Are you exploring that?
I once did a study
in
college.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Let me end now by making a deeper link to medical expert systems and diagnostic search. I think you find this interesting. And I'm not going to go through the detail of this work. It's a little bit nuanced, but this is our SIG-IR paper from last year, 2011, with our intern, Mark Cartwright. So in medical school, we all learned about this methodology called hypothetico-deductive reasoning, and it was the foundations of the first probability-based expert systems. There's some initial symptoms or observations or signs. There's some evidence-directed inference and reasoning is done. A probabilistic model is used to infer likelihoods of different diseases here. And then, given the uncertainty, you can say, should I stop now and take action, or do a hypothesis-directed, take the probabilities and the hypothesis set here, turn it around, and compute value information, and and which asks for more questions that get answers get inputted here, and you cycle until you stop. And this loop was the foundations of a work by Gori and Kassira on their cardiac and renal expert systems. That's where they work. We built Pathfinder back in the 80s that worked on this methodology and so on. Hypothetical active reasoning, it's the way we kind of think at times in an uncertain world with sequential next best steps typically being taken. At this point, like it's a computer when new evidence comes in and diseases are ruled out or demoted and so on, we sort it. That's how that works until you end up stopping for a variety of reasons, including the value of new evidence is not worth the cost of the evidence or the cost of the test. So I believe that when people are turning to the search engines, they're basically doing a kind of a coarse, hypothetical, deductive reasoning with two entry points, where the web is the inference engine. To them, the web and search results are the inference engine. And so here's some actual cases. And what I'm going to show you here is these actual search sessions here. This is the seconds of dwell off, when someone goes after that query off the web pages and then back again and then re-queries and so on. For the next, typically means page down on results or re-query, we can't tell sometimes. But someone here is starting out evidence directed here, up here, abdominal and back pain. And they're spending quite a bit of time, looks like about 15 minutes or so, reading about abdominal and back pain. And finally, they say, oh, liver pain. So they're changing the location of this pain, trying to figure out where it is from the web interaction here. It's rising up to abdominal and shoulder pain now. They're trying to sort of focus in on how to describe it, what it is they have. And finally, all of a sudden, they come down to gallbladder symptoms. And now, if you continue on, they're going to start going up this way, in this loop here. Here's another example. Someone starting with evidence directed here. Feeling shaky. These are kind of, they're getting web page. They're reading the pages. Shaky and nauseous. Somehow, their interaction with the web has led them to spend 17 seconds reading about low blood sugar levels. So they've now gone down and they have a hypothesis, right? And they're basically coming back again. And looking for what are symptoms of this. So they actually are trying to get more, they're coming through the computation here now to come back around. Here's another example. Pain in ear, throat, so on. Someone finally decides here that the pain in ear and throat and shoulders is their sternocleidomastoid muscle. Now God knows what page they looked at to bring them here. But we actually have the browse trace. We can look at the page ourselves and maybe start holding our neck and lifting around the lab at Microsoft Research. And then they want to go. Then they go from there to TMJ here. So they're basically in jaw symptoms. Here's another one. Where's your appendix? Pain left corner of my stomach. Lower left corner. Burning feeling in my stomach on lower left side. Navigation query, it's going back here again. Now they decided it's pelvic inflammatory disease. And then they go around and say, wait a minute, they're coming back around again. It might be stomach gas, maybe, and so on. And here's somebody, interestingly enough, who starts out here, says, sacroiliac joint pain. And look at this, it's 42.8 minutes, 60 actions like this. Someone's really dwelling on many pages on sacroiliac joint pain, at which time they decide time for action. And they spend over 12 and a half minutes checking out surgeons, remove the stape in this case for sacroiliac joint surgery. Now, the general case here is, and you'll see in our SIGIR 2011 paper, is this, which captures a coarse version of hypothetical deductive reasoning with human beings in the loop with a search engine, where they can loop around this way a search engine works very optimally, or for human beings dwelling on information about the evidence. What do you mean by the symptom? Or more about this disease. And then into the hypothetical protective loop. And we've characterized this process in a very, very large study, large-scale web, in the Savara 2011 paper. Yeah?
Eric, I wonder if you thought about an alternative way of interpreting these queries, that rather than someone actually holding the hypothesis that they have this new disease that they're investigating, maybe one further back, because this is so specific. But maybe people are updating their utility. They're increasing their utility by getting more knowledge about what they don't have. And so if I see that this is the differential diagnosis, now I'm just going to investigate each of these conditions until I can reassure myself that I actually don't have those things.
Sure. I mean, you can imagine, and in fact, in the world of expert systems, we had rule-out mode, right? So you can imagine, you know, asking questions to rule out a disease. We can actually, in some of our problem-solving systems like Pathfinder, you can actually say, change your strategy to rule this disease out. Ask different kinds of questions for that. This versus everything else to separate, rule out, call that rule out mode. So yeah, you can imagine that's going on. I still think you can characterize it by this. Maybe I changed the language in which I describe these cases, but I would still probably say that this kind of model here captures what's sort of going on. You know, because you might say, well, I'm trying to rule things out here. That's actually what value information does. It says, well, do I really have this? What's the next best reading I should do or task I should do to rule out this thing? It really says, I want to basically collapse. I mean, you do this optimally with value information computations. You're trying to collapse the list of diseases by likelihood differential down to one disease or no disease, 1.0. That's the goal you have. Yeah.
So I see this as more evidence of a much larger trend, which is the trend away from the physician as God. So, you know, 30 years ago, you would just bring your symptoms and go see the doctor regularly and take what he says as truth. And now, suddenly, laymen are acting as physicians.
Yeah, I was on stage with I'm losing his name right now, the Google medical director, was his title at least, with IBM myself, with a connected healthcare meeting.
Ronnie Zeiger,
that's who it was. And he made the comment that, I guess he's an ER doc, and he made the comment to this large audience that he's in the ER and it's nighttime and some patient comes in, I think it was a multiple myeloma patient and family, he made the comment that he could just assume that the family and patient know more than him about multiple myeloma these days. So it's like, you know, another interesting comment that he made, like, you know, the doctors themselves can be very, very humble about when it comes to like a rare disease. Right. If they're like an ER doc, great ER doc, you know, they have to assume that the family and the patient knows more than them about many aspects of this illness.
It's just a reversal of where things used to be.
Yeah, in some ways, right. We found, actually, we've done a more recent, this survey you can read about on the web also probed physicians' feelings about search. Well, actually, from the view of the Microsoft employees, like, what was your doctor's attitudes about you coming to them with search information? After we asked, did you provide the information? And there was kind of a mixture of responses. Some said, no, they actually liked it, they invited it. Some said they were, you know, maybe a little bit defensive about it. Yeah?
I would actually be interested in seeing how
absolutely.
Strategies, and the principle for physicians often to rule out the worst, as you were saying just now. And so, how does this affect healthcare costs and utilization of tests?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we just recently started, and we've done some work on detecting expertise level in the logs. And this is work that Susan Dumais and Ryan White did earlier. We looked at both medical and I think it was. Financial, got the second example, but they actually have various signs for detecting is it an expert or not searching. More recently, we're looking at a larger group. What's the transition between consumer speak and expert speak by the consumers? We think as they sort of you saw a little bit of that in my examples here. They start with some pain in my tummy, and then all of a sudden they're talking about cholecystitis. So, what's the, for better or for worse, what's the transition of those terminology, but I think your questions are interesting to see, can we segment out likely core expert practitioners and see what they're using the web for, and in an anonymized way, track how the web might be influencing a point of care based on web content and resources. Very interesting study. We have a PhD student looking for a topic in the room.
Yeah.
Are you pushing this work a little bit further so that somehow reflecting what you learned from this study in the algorithm so that
Absolutely.
Make people less anxious?
Yeah. we spent a couple pages, at least two or three pages, in our TOAS paper talking about how this could be, how this problem could be addressed. We're always thinking about how to leverage the results, both as warnings and so on, as well as in actual machinery ranking algorithms. Wouldn't it be nice to have models like this built by experts running these Bayesian models? It's had this out as possible discussion point that would actually take a chief complaint and actually start doing this reasoning for you and actually bring a medical expert system from our community to the web. And I think this is the long term goal. The shorter term version of that would be just likelihoods or flags that this was going on, and what better indexing to not take to introduce some notion of probabilistic inference, even lightweight, to web indexing when it comes to events versus page relevance. Lots to discuss there. I think that the warnings are also kind of nice. I mean, this work, it was very rewarding to see this work led to a firestorm of news stories. You know, almost every journalist that I spoke to or interviewed with would whisper before the broadcast, or even in real time on the air, say, "I thought I had ALS for like 6 months." To be honest to everybody, all my listeners, this is really affecting me. And whenever I would mention this to any family member, people, you know, like distant from my cousins, people would just like collapse in a pool of like, "I thought it was just me." So it's a widespread challenge, and even in this room, I'm sure people have done symptom searches and have raised eyebrows about what it might mean. And so it's a very wide-scale problem, and I think bringing it to light through the media helped out a lot, and the Pew Internet Trust and so on has been pushing this some more. And there's been a lot of follow-on work now on physicians making comments on this, physician strategies, we've done patients about the web. And now recently I saw there's a psychological science paper coming out about another explanation for people's reaction, talking about making allusions to gambling. Anyway, yeah, Winona.
Sorry.
No, sorry.
Is this your web-based data push through time, or is it a static
data set? Oh, we don't have a pipe with a headphone listening into the web in real time. Those feeds are available, I'm sure, but we take big static chunks of data. They're very large sets and work with it and clean it use it over time.
Did you in any way that you deal with contextual environmental
things
that increase
probability of research? Oh, I mean, if you're thinking of Google flu trends and looking at things like that. We're doing studies like that right now. In fact, we're actually more so even looking at some of our large medical databases in like our DC partners for how flu and flu reports affect people, what happens in the emergency room. But we've done other work, non-medical, but including some medical. We have a dub paper coming out actually next week in Lyon, France. This is with Kira Radinsky, who's an intern last fall, on a really fun paper on looking at the temporal dynamics of queries and relevant pages, how they change over time. And there's all sorts of dynamics and how we modeled that. It was a fun piece of work. Looking at that. We've thought about doing that for medical. We haven't yet dived into that very deeply. We did do a study of predicting cholera outbreaks from news stories that's maybe a little bit relevant to this. That was using New York Times archives. But it's an interesting area to look at.
So
Which gets the utility model.
I don't know how to use this. Stop.